This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 28th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and by your state society of CPAs. Let's remind you, this particular structure, we have a number of courses coming up in a number of locations, so check your state's CPA society's calendar to see what's coming up. I'm going to be doing sessions coming up the end of September in Ohio, in the Cincinnati area. So if you want to come down there and take a couple of courses at the end of September, you can check the Ohio Society calendar. Later in the year, after the 15th of October, I'll also be doing tax conferences in Minnesota, Oklahoma, Arizona, Oregon, basically a number of those conferences coming up. Oh yeah, and New Mexico, can't forget them. So we'll have a bunch of conferences coming up doing that and a bunch of sessions here toward the end of the year, a number more here in Phoenix, some also in Boise. We'll have sessions coming up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and a few other locations. So, Miami, Florida too, can't forget that. So I'll be down there. That'll actually be in December, which is not a bad time to be in Miami. So look forward to some of you are available. See you coming to one of those courses. Let's talk about what's going on this week and what's happened. It was kind of an interesting week because we had a lot of things go on. And we actually got guidance in a case that had been, that there had been quite a bit of interest in how this one was going to turn out. The tax court took their first look at the micro-captive insurance industry in the case of Avarami versus Commissioner. And I probably mispronounced the gentleman's name, and that's probably more of a problem because this is a Phoenix case, so hopefully I didn't do too bad on it. But this is 149 TC number 17. The case came down on August the 21st of 2017. This is a case dealing with this concept known as a micro-captive insurance company. And the first thing to let you know is that the IRS clearly doesn't like micro-captives. They really don't like them. They dislike them totally. But so let's talk about why they dislike them. And one of the catches, there are two rules that you have to understand the concept of a micro-captive. Some of you may have already had clients that have been approached to set up micro-captives. You may be involved with micro-captive structures. And some of you may have like, I don't know what you're talking about. So let's talk about the concept here. There are two different concepts we combine to get to the micro-captive structure. The first one is the concept of a captive insurance company. And that's essentially a case where companies have set up, normally in offshore locations, a company, an insurance company, that issues policies to the company, insuring various risks. Now, as long as you meet certain criteria, those structures have been upheld by the courts as good. Remember, the key problem is here, it has to be true insurance. Merely setting aside funds in case there's a problem in the future is not insurance, and that's not deductible. But if you actually set up a true insurance structure, then you can have an insurance company that you essentially control that insures your risks. And we've seen the proper structures. We have cases like the Rent-A-Center case, 142 TC number 1. We also have a case of Americo Sales versus Commissioner. That's 98 TC number 18, going back a little bit further. We have cases where the tax court has backed that up. The IRS, of course, initially had this theory that these things were merely setting aside funds and trying to claim a deduction for setting aside funds to be used for, you know, uncertain future problems or, you know, future losses. So we're trying to accrue these losses ahead of time. Nevertheless, we found out about a structure. Key issue is those companies have to show they're truly issuing insurance. And there are various tests that are used to determine if the company truly issues insurance. But if it meets that test, we're fine. Now let's talk about the second special rule. And this is one that, you know, is going to help us create this thing called a micro captive. Insurance companies are subject to special tax rules, and we're looking here at the tax rules that impact small insurance companies other than life insurance companies. And those rules are found in Section 831 of the Code. If an insurance company is small enough, then in fact, it doesn't pay tax. you know, basically it has its premiums, it receives premiums, and it pays no tax on receipt of premiums, nor does it pay any tax on its investment. Now that's at one level. A secondary level, and this is the one we're going to work with here. If an insurance company has premiums no more than a certain level, so again, the first level was for a level which was around $600,000 for the year in question, then we could escape tax entirely. That's not what we're using here. At the secondary level, we have one where if an insurance company has premiums that it receives of less than $1.2 million, it can elect to be taxed as an insurance company, right? And that will not pay tax on its premiums, but will only pay tax on its investment income. If you combine those two concepts, and by the way, for the years in question, that particular cap was $1.2 million. A micro-captive structure seeks to combine those two issues. So we're going to set up an insurance company that we control. We're going to try to make sure it has premiums of less than $1.2 million. And therefore, the only income we'll recognize is income on the investments held by the insurance company. That allows a pretty substantial deduction to an operating company that has insurable risks. But those funds are really just going into another pocket. And if, in fact, we don't end up triggering a payout where the proceeds have to be used and the company actually retains its surplus and is able to hold on to those funds, then you could have a pretty substantial, effectively deductible set of funds going to a location where all we're going to pay tax on, unless we bring the funds back, is going to be the income, the investment income it receives. So that's the concept of a micro captive. It's an insurance company we control, but it's small enough that its premiums never go over that $1.2 million limitation. This was the case here in this particular, in the Avrahami case. That's really the issue we were setting with here. This taxpayer had various entities. And what he did was he formed a captive insurance company. He had three jewelry stores, and then he had a number of shopping centers. And he formed this captive insurance company offshore in St. Kitts that would issue insurance to this company. Now, interestingly enough, they designed the structure so that the insurance policies written effectively, including one special one we'll talk about here in just a second, the terrorist policy, ended up with premiums of just under $1.2 million. That was probably not accidental. The other issue that occurs in this case is that this insurance company didn't insure what we might call traditional insurance risk. It insured things that were less traditional. The company still maintained its standard insurance it had always maintained with traditional commercial carriers for standard types of liability issues. So it had all of those standard coverages, but then it had this particular additional concepts that it covered. So it set up this company. The company, even though it was in St. Kitts, it elected to be treated as a domestic corporation for U.S. purposes because it needs to be that to make this thing work. And then we make the small insurance company election. Okay, the insurance policies that this company, which was called Feedback, issued were policies that protected business income, employee fidelity, litigation expense, loss of key employees, tax indemnity, that was an interesting one, cost of administrative actions, and business risk indemnity. These policies generally all provided that they wouldn't kick in until after any amounts that could be received from the other policies had already been paid. He also went out and bought from another company, Pan American, which we'll discover is related here, a policy for terrorism insurance. This terrorism insurance policy, which was kind of interesting, it effectively covered them for certain terrorist events. But it specifically didn't cover any event taking place in a city of more than 1.5 million people. Now, and it kind of vaguely described, it didn't really describe what a city was well, and it wasn't clear how this was going to work. So we had $360,000 worth of premiums over here on this terrorism policy. And then effectively, they came up with policies that filled in the remainder. So we got just below $1.2 million of premiums. Now, the tax court took a look at this. The IRS argued, look, guys, this is all a scheme to generate tax deduction for payments that weren't really insurance. You know, create a tax advantage structure. The taxpayers said no, captive insurance companies work, no question that's true, and we're simply taking advantage of a standard provision. Well, the tax court said we need to look at it. They said, really, we understand the basic concept here. Yes, captive insurance is a workable concept. You know, it exists. You can have a real captive insurance company, and the small insurance company election is also perfectly okay. So the court said there was really only one question we had to decide. Was feedback actually in the business of issuing insurance policies? Because if what we're paying them for is not insurance, then what we're going to have is going to be a distribution indirect dividend to the owner. We're going to have a disallowed deduction on the companies or the rentals because for the shopping centers. So we either have disallowed deductions and potentially an indirect dividend, or we're going to end up with actual insurance premiums. And the court said the question of whether something is insurance is a facts and circumstances test. And you need to look at the following four key things. Does the arrangement involve risk shifting? Does it involve risk distribution? Does it involve insurance risk? And does the arrangement meet the commonly accepted notions of insurance? Now, the taxpayers claim that they distributed risk in two ways. First, they claimed that based on the Humana opinion, that we could have a sufficiently diverse set of insurance risks inside of our own companies that we don't even need to insure anybody else. We could generate insurance risk internally, right? If we had enough of those different policies. But secondly, they said that feedback, in addition to writing the policies for this company, also took on a reinsurance program. The reinsurance was reinsuring terrorism insurance from, you guessed it, Pan American. So they came in and they received a premium, which, by the way, was basically effectively equal to what Pan American was going to receive from the operating companies as the premium for the policy. And they would receive that premium. And they would agree, therefore, to cover a certain percentage of the risk of terrorism activities, which was practically the percentage of risk that really represented this company of the group. So Pan American insured a bunch of companies, but the way the structure was set up, every time Pan American insured a company, they effectively then went out and got reinsurance from the related captive company. And they bought the reinsurance that way. But they're saying, because we're in there, but look, even though we have this relationship, which is fine, we're still, if somebody else gets hit by a terrorism incident, you know, our company feedback would still have to pony up at least its share of the claim. So that means that actually we have over 30% of our premiums are being received from unrelated parties. And based on that, that means we have adequate risk distribution. Now, you know, the IRS objected to both lines. First, the IRS said, look, feedback only insured three or four related entities. And the tax court agreed with the IRS right away on this one. Because they said, look, even the expert testifying for feedback had indicated you needed a minimum of essentially, you know, seven different affiliated policyholders. You know, either 12 or seven policyholders, depending upon the nature of the relationship, in order to have a sufficiently diverse group. In this particular case, they had far fewer than that. They didn't have enough to cover either of the two rules. So based on that, the tax court said, look, your own expert's opinion says you can't possibly qualify under this first rule. The court noted, in the case of Harper, where a company internally could theoretically have enough risks to be covered, they were covering 7,500 different insured entities versus this very small number here. Then they said, even if you had enough entities, there's still enough to show a distribution of risk, because they said the real question there is risk exposure. And they pointed out that in cases where they had found enough risk exposure, they had cases where they had, you know, a number of different things. Like one particular case, they covered 750,000 different vehicles, 2,000 real estate properties, and 1.3 million equipment assets in seven different geographic regions. That spread out the risk. That wasn't happening here. All of these insured entities were located, you know, in a smaller geographic area, the state of Arizona generally, and a lot of it was concentrated heavily in the Phoenix metropolitan area, which meant that there just wasn't enough spread with that. There just simply isn't enough there. Now, that meant the taxpayers back to Pan American. And the court had a real problem with Pan American. They said, number one, again, you're reading the case law that you said that 30% test, you know, we've seen these cases, you have 30%, you're fine. Said that's too narrow. They said the problem, the percentage only matters if what Pan American was providing was actually insurance. And they found several issues with their operations. You know, effectively what they said was, look, there's this recycling of money. You put 360 in, and within a year, you get 360 back out in a related company. So 360 comes from the operating entities. And then within a year, that 360 has drifted back to the related captive insurance company. So saying, well, that, you know, that looks like just a simple recycling, right? Also, Pan American didn't hold on to anywhere near enough funds to either operate as an insurance company or a high enough fee to cover the credit risk. Even if you claim they got rid of all the risk by going out to the others, they still would have the credit risk if one of the others didn't pay. And as the court pointed out, considering that these reinsurance companies they were buying from were generally small captives who, in the terms of the court, would freak if they ever had a loss that came from something other than their own companies, and so very well might not pay. So Pan American could have to go after tons of very small captive insurance carriers trying to collect money. They said they're not getting paid almost anything for doing this, and they're retaining almost nothing. So the court found that, in fact, you know, there's just not enough there. It was, you know, it doesn't qualify to distribute risks. Then they said the other problem was what we're operating here just doesn't even look like an operating company anyway. We've got a number of problems here. They said, first thing is, the policies themselves were unclear in many cases. You know, it didn't say for sure how it would be covered or what it would do. They also made investments that, in the words of the court, only an unthinking insurance company would make. They took the money they got and they loaned it back out to relatives, basically to entities controlled by the owners of the company, that went out and borrowed to buy real estate and then had due dates way in the future. So that if, in fact, Feedback had to pay a claim, they had no ready source of cash to pay it from. So they said only a really unthinking insurance company would make itself this illiquid. It wouldn't keep enough liquidity to be able to cover, you know, any claim that, you know, the sorts of claims that might reasonably arise. They're saying that doesn't look good. They also had trouble that it appeared obviously, you know, the premiums were being geared intentionally. They did hire an actuary to come up and come up with a justification for the premiums, but the court did not like this person's methodology. And fundamentally, it's clear the court was suspicious that amazingly, we dialed in our assumptions and changed things like deductibles to magically get ourselves right at, but not quite over, $1.2 million coming into Feedback, remembering that's the magic level. So because of that, the court found that, in fact, there was no insurance company. With no insurance company, they didn't pay for insurance. There was no insurance being purchased. Therefore, the deductions were totally disallowed, and the amounts were considered an indirect distribution to the shareholders, or, you know, or to the rent, or to the owners, the landlords. Now, what does this tell us? First thing to recognize here, it does not tell us micro-captive does not work, but it certainly suggests it may be very difficult to make it work. You really need to have some serious showing that you have risk, that you're spreading the risk out in a way that's adequate. Also, key warning, the tax court, because it didn't need to, didn't even advance on to other attacks that would go after economic substance and the like that theoretically could be used to attack this, even if you could show insurance. So you got to be realize that too. Obviously, if you have a situation, you know, where you already have a micro captive and your fact pattern looks like this one, you got a big problem. If you're trying to set one up, then you better make darn sure you address all of the issues here. You know, make sure that you get the risk spread enough. And that may be difficult while staying under that $1.2 million level. And the other problem is that risk spreading is probably going to mean that there are going to be some claims. So it's not just going to magically be able to have this thing that has a growing chunk of money that most likely, unless you have some total disaster not covered by insurance that befalls the company, that's never going to really be paid. So just kind of be careful here. The taxpayers did escape penalties. That was the good news because the court indicated there's really been no guidance on this. They did consult with an attorney who was ruled not to be the promoter of this operation, which was very important because, by the way, they could not rely on the CPA to prepare the return because the CPA admitted that he just basically did the bookkeeping work and he didn't really, you know, rule on or decide. He relied totally on the attorneys that said that this thing worked. They couldn't rely on the attorney who actually was the one that set up most of the companies because she was a promoter. She was found to be a promoter. They only worked with her for this issue, and her being paid depended upon them going forward with this. That was true. There was another attorney in the middle who was generally doing estate plans, but did work with them some on this concept and did some broad consulting in the area. And the court found that that reliance on that attorney who had been working in this area was enough to allow them to escape the 20% penalty. Because, yeah, this is going to be a substantial understatement. And the court, you know, didn't even go after the question of was there substantial authority. My guess is you'd probably have trouble winning that one on this one, but they didn't go there. They said they had reasonable basis, reasonable cause. Next up, we have another case here, PASA Staffing Services versus Commissioner. This is an unpublished tax court decision, which I love to say unpublished, but obviously it's on the web. Docket number 6881-12R is a tax court order and decision issued on the 17th of August. In this case, we had a taxpayer that set up an employee stock ownership program. Now, he did that, acquired a company, and he set it up, and for the year he set it up, he was the only owner. The company bought the stock. The ESOPs bought the stock from the company. He was the only person. He received compensation that first year. It was all allocated to him. The following year, he has a second entity that was set up that was effectively this company called Golden Gate, and it would lease employees. And basically, he receives, therefore, a salary, but then he has all the rank and file in this other entity. Now, the ESOP continued, but none of the other people, even though they qualified to come into the ESOP if we combine the two entities, none of them ever received an allocation. Now, this in one sense was not unusual. You know, basically, the idea that we wanted to isolate the owner from the rank and file and be able to fund a plan for only the owner, you know, was kind of the holy grail for a long time. People wanted to figure out ways to get that done. But the problem is Congress figured out that that's also something they don't like. So the question is, had he triggered one of the rules where they had to cover employees of the other entity? One of the reasons you have to cover other employees is if, in fact, you have a controlled group. Now, the court doesn't tell us why he didn't believe he had one. But it appears that he or his owner, he or, you know, his advisor, had decided that the ESOP, shares held by the ESOP, which controlled 100% of the one company, that those would not be attributed to the participants, by the way, which was only him, as shares held. So even though he held 100% of the stock in the leasing company, you know, their position was the ESOP was a shareholder of the other company. But the tax court noted that, in fact, if you take a look at the related party rules that are triggered by the rules for controlled groups, you'll discover that a beneficiary of a trust, you know, who has a 5% or greater actuarial interest in the stock of the held by the trust, is deemed to be an owner to the extent of that interest. Well, doctor, in this case, the doctor had 100% interest in that. So bottom line, they was considered to be the owner. They had to combine both companies. Really bad news is that ends up with a situation where we had the IRS went after and was granted a total disqualification for the plan. Next case up, the Luzantaville Country Club versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum 2017-158, issued on August the 15th. This deals with a not-for-profit social club, 501c7 organization. It had unrelated business taxable income that arose from investments that it held. But it also had some sales to non-members of the country club. And what it wanted to do was offset. It computed a loss from the sales to non-members. And it did that by a gross-to-gross computation. So it went gross sales to members, gross sales to non-members, and it allocated the fixed cost based on that split between those two. And based on that, it had a loss from sales to non-members. The law is fairly clear that for unrelated business income tax, you can offset ones with income from ones with losses, but only if the ones with losses were entered into with the objective of making a profit. Here's where people got a little confused, and at some point they were arguing that we should be able to use the test under the hobby loss rules of Section 183 in order to determine if the country club was in this to make additional money. The tax court said, guys, that's not really the test. In the case of a not-for-profit, you have to show that you have as a goal to receive more income from these people than their allocable share of expenses, which will include those fixed expenses, a portion of them that would exist even if we didn't do this. And under 183, you could argue that that should be ignored. You know, if there was some fixed cost or be incurred either way, that doesn't really impact the profit motive. But here it does. And you have to use that annual activity. I can't look for some future benefit that we'd get. I have no idea. We'd sell the country club and supposedly having the non-members would make it worthwhile. I have no idea what the idea would be, but you can't use 183. Because it did not apply to a social club, you had to use a different result, and that was a problem for them. Finally, we're going to look at a case here where we've got Summers versus Commissioner. Actually, two are coming up here. This is an interesting case. The taxpayer had made a net gift shortly before he died. Net gifts is where I give you something, but when there, if there's gift tax due on that gift, you as the recipient have to agree to pay it. The gift I give would be the total value of what I gave you less the gift tax that you're going to pay. He gave this gift shortly before death. The tax was not actually paid by the donees until after the date of death. The estate tried to argue that under the regulation, if you read it, it says that an estate gets a deduction for any unpaid gift tax. We have to bring the whole value back in. We have to bring the gift back into the estate, but then we get to claim a deduction for the gift tax. And they're saying, despite the fact we're not going to pay that gift tax, we still should get to deduct it. So let's do some numbers here. Let's assume the gift tax was, let's say it was $100,000 gift, 40% gift tax. So I'd have made a net gift of $60,000. That's what's going to be shown as my transfer. Well, not really. You're going to have to do the math and back into it. But, you know, basically, let's say that that would be it. So let's say I gave a gift. That would work out so that my net gift was, you know, my gift tax is going to work out that way. So I would take the gift tax out of it, right? And I'd put, let's say, $75,000. Let's say that's what the math worked for. And I keep the 25 out. So we're going to add this 75 back in, but now they're going to want to deduct the 25. So effectively only 50 would be coming back in. The court said can't do that. They said, in fact, what happened was when you transferred the entire gift to the donees, you effectively paid the gift tax because you gave them the resources with which to pay the gift tax. And you only paid tax on the net gift. So the rest of that transfer was the gift tax. Therefore, you get no deduction. Next up, final thing here is an interesting one. The Chief Counsel Advice, 2017-33013, issued on August 18th. Under Revenue Procedure 8435, certain small partnerships can get out of the failure to file penalty if they meet certain requirements. Okay, they have to have 10 or fewer partners. Each partner must be an individual or the estate of a deceased partner. Each partner had to report the income deduction items as reported on, as would have been reported on their K-1, has to be properly reported on their return. We've never, we've not elected to be a TEFRA partnership. You know, if all those things are true, we can get out of the penalty. And most of us have worked that role before. An agent was asking, somebody in the IRS was asking, well, does that really mean that small partnerships don't need to file a return? The IRS disagrees. They say, no, you still have to establish your right. You're still subject to the penalty, and you have to establish the right. If they don't file a return, then we're never going to know about these things, and that can't happen. The interesting side here is they really didn't directly answer the question that was being posed. But one thing to remember is all of these rules under 8435 are tied to the old TEFRA rules. Now, we're about to go outside the TEFRA partnership rules now. It will be interesting to see, and you should consider, is this rule going to survive our transition into the new Bipartisan Budget Act audit regime when we start with 2018 returns? That's not totally clear. Certainly, we need to at least revise this ruling. The problem is, under the Bipartisan Budget Act, the small partnership has to opt out of the regime with a timely election. If they don't file a return, they won't opt out. If they don't opt out, then they're in the regime. If they're in the regime, that's like being under TEFRA, which under RevProc 8435 would kind of say you couldn't get relief. So watch this one for developments over the next year. As always, we remind you that, you know, check your state CPA, your state CPA societies for courses that are being offered. Oh, by the way, if you're not aware, your state CPA society can also set up, if your firm has enough people to make it worthwhile, you can actually bring in instructors. Most instructors will do sessions on site. Obviously, you have to have enough people to make the math work, you know, for handling the travel and the fee for the instructor and all that stuff. But if you have enough people, and I've done it for groups of around 20, you know, up to groups of, you know, 100 plus, you know, we've done those. If you have one of those, consider contacting your state societies. We are available to handle those sorts of courses if you want to do it. And, you know, you can contact through the state societies to set that up. This has been the current federal tax developments for this for the week of August the 28th. You can catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com online. Well, daily, quasi, whatever you want to call them. They're more often than weekly, but they're not really daily. We'll push things there we think they're worthwhile. You can also download the materials for this week from that website, so you can get a PDF with articles about everything I discussed this week. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. It'll be at edzollers is where you'll find me there. Well, it's been an interesting week, and hopefully we'll see what comes up in the next week. And I hope to see you all back here a week from now as we discuss the most current federal tax developments.